A body was found, face down in a drainage ditch with a sword impaled in the left part of its chest on October 16, 1678. The rapid identification of the cadaver as Sir Edmund Barry Godfrey's sparked a swirl of events that ended in the executions of 35 Catholics and the formation of the Whig Party. Today on Footnoting History, I'll tell you more. Welcome to Footnoting History. I'm Sam, and I'll be telling you a very strange story today. But before I get to my story, I'd like to remind you that if you want more information on this podcast, you can visit our website at www.footnotinghistory.com for more information, including a brief bibliography. You can also find out more information about our podcast on the website. The story I have to tell you today revolves around two rather unlovable men. Neither one intended to have the impact he did, nor did either one have much control over the events that swirled around them. I'll start my story today with the senior of the two men, Edmund Barry Godfrey, who always dropped the Barry when he signed his own name, so I will follow that convention from here on in, was born into a rather typical gentry family on December 23, 1621. His father, Thomas Godfrey, had a good local reputation, but in spite of serving in three parliaments, he had no real influence on national events. Though a moderate in most respects, Thomas held the radical belief that people should be allowed to worship as they pleased, and he taught his sons to be tolerant towards Catholics. Thomas also valued education, and so he sent all of his sons, including Edmund, off to live and learn at the Westminster School, which was at that time emerging as the preeminent school for educating gentlemen. Most of young Godfrey's time there was spent learning grammar and Latin alongside a smattering of geography and classical history. While the school itself was eminently respectable, the headmaster was not. Since this is footnoting history, I will vocalize what would otherwise have been a mere footnote by telling you that in 1638, the school's headmaster was sent before the Star Chamber for committing rude words about Archbishop Laud to paper. He was sentenced to have his ears nailed to a pillory whilst standing before his own school, but the sentence was never carried out because the culprit was forewarned and managed to disappear until Laud himself fell from favor, at which point the penalty was conveniently forgotten. But you do have to love these Tudor and Stuart punishments. But let's get back to our main protagonist here, Edmund Godfrey. When he was 16, Godfrey was admitted to Christ Church College at Oxford, where he distinguished himself through his diligence. We don't know much about his life at Oxford, apart from the fact that he wrote some really dreadful poetry. We don't even know if he completed his degree. We do know that after leaving Oxford, he traveled for a time on the continent, from whence he returned in 1640. Thereupon, he entered Gray's Inn and began a promising career at the bar. But before long, severe illness and increasing deafness forced him to abandon his legal studies. I will note, significantly, that some of his early biographers speculated that the real reason Godfrey left was that he had a breakdown which forced him to stop work. While Godfrey did interact with a healer, his hearing loss was not severe enough to have a significant impact on his later career. Later in life, however, Godfrey was known for being rather solitary and gloomy, so perhaps depression did play a role in ending his studies. And if so, depression might also have played a role in his premature death. After leaving Gray's Inn, Godfrey retired to the countryside to rethink his future, while also avoiding getting entangled in the English Civil War. He returned to the metropolis in 1650, at which time he entered into a partnership with a family friend named James Harrison to become a woodmonger and coal merchant. Woodmongers effectively served as middlemen, buying wood and coal and selling it to people in the city who needed it to heat their homes. Their position was important, powerful, and potentially lucrative. But one should keep in mind that woodmongers often got into conflicts with those who ended up interacting with them, including carmen who actually transported the fuel and the wharfingers whose wharves they used. Godfrey proved to be a successful businessman, and his business prospered. A few years later, Harrison retired and Godfrey took over the business, reorienting it to focus on furnishing fuel for Westminster rather than the City of London. The timing for this move, as it turns out, was a good one. Cromwell had recently died, and his son would not prove to be an able successor. The return of the monarchy would mean a restoration of court life, which was mostly based in Westminster. As his business grew, so too did Godfrey's reputation and his social and political obligations. He was tapped to become an alderman for Farringdon Ward, but he turned down the honor. He also refused to take up the post as sheriff multiple times, paying a fine in lieu of service. This decision was not particularly remarkable. While these roles were prestigious ones, they were also expensive and time-consuming, and Godfrey was by no means alone in his decision to avoid holding office. Godfrey did, however, choose to serve as the master of the Woodmongers' Company for much of the 1660s. This position gave him considerable control over pricing, so when the Woodmongers were fined in 1667 for gouging the poor with high prices, Godfrey was first among those punished. Not only did Godfrey pay a hefty fine, in the end, the Woodmongers' Company itself lost its charter and the right to regulate pricing. Godfrey vigorously opposed the dissolution of the company. In his professional life, Godfrey often relied on his keen understanding of the law. In particular, he proved to be rather litigious when people did not pay him in a timely manner. On one occasion, his intransigence caused him some personal grief. In 1669, he tried to pursue a debt from the king's personal physician. He ended up instead being incarcerated himself for 7 days. Later, he initiated numerous suits against his nephew, Godfrey Harrison, who, as it turns out, was a less than capable protege and lost his uncle a lot of money. Outside of business, Godfrey cultivated his reputation as a man of law and became a justice of the peace in Westminster. While Edmund had avoided other costly offices, he was eager to take up the mantle of justices of the peace as his father and brother had done before him. In this capacity, Godfrey served as an administrator, a judge, an arbitrator, and a detective. While these roles helped garner both power and authority, they frequently entailed making enemies, particularly those who ran afoul of the law and their families. While many justices did not live up to the ideals of office, which included being impartial, somber, and honest, Godfrey seems to have tried to execute his office fairly. In particular, he enjoyed playing the role of the amateur sleuth and consistently followed through on cases that were brought to him, even if doing so placed him in danger. We actually have records of several instances in which he faced violent backlash for enforcing the law. It's worth noting at this point that Godfrey demonstrated a reticence to execute laws that he deemed unjust, including those that involved persecuting Catholics. The height of Godfrey's power came in 1665, when a plague struck London, leaving Edmund as the chief magistrate for his district. As a reward for his good service, he was given a knighthood and £200 worth of silver plate, including a fine drinking vessel with a dedication to him graved upon it, though he did initially try to turn down these honors. But while on the surface Godfrey was doing well, he remained a solitary and aloof man who preferred to be on his own. He never married, though that in and of itself is not particularly noteworthy. What his contemporaries were much more concerned about is the fact that he often interacted with men who were below his social station. In September 1678, Dr. Israel Tonge approached Godfrey as a local justice of the peace and requested that he take a sworn deposition from Titus Oates, who, according to Tonge, had uncovered a popish plot to kill the king. And now I need to pause to introduce our second major player, Titus Oates. Oates was 29 years old when he met Sir Edmund Godfrey, and he had quite the disreputable life. He was raised the son of a Baptist preacher who had served as the chaplain to Colonel Pride's regiment during the Civil Wars. When the crown was restored, however, the family decided to rejoin the Church of England. Oates' childhood was not an easy one. His father was abusive and distinctly disliked his sickly younger son. In 1664, Titus attended the Merchant Taylor's School in London, where he studied under William Smith, whom he later accused of participating in the Popish plot. Smith, believing that Oates was a dullard and a cheat, expelled him from the school, whereupon he moved to a different institution before finally ending up at Caius College, Cambridge. After failing to distinguish himself there, he transferred to St. John's College, where he fared no better. Ultimately, he left the university without a degree. But that hardly mattered, because he told everyone that he had gotten a BA, and these false claims proved sufficient for him to get a preacher's license, and ultimately even to take holy orders in May of 1670. Oates briefly became a vicar, but was dismissed after alienating his parishioners. At that point, he became his father's curate. But he lost that position too after falsely accusing the local schoolmaster of sodomy in hopes of taking over his position. Now facing charges of perjury, Oates fled London and became a naval chaplain in 1675. He would later claim that it was whilst serving aboard the Adventure that he first caught wind of the Popish plot. When the ship got back to England, Oates was expelled from the Navy for his indiscreet liaisons with men and returned to London. There he encountered his former tutor, William Smith, and a Catholic man named Matthew Medburn. before being arrested to await his trial for perjury. Once again, Oates managed to escape, and he used his acquaintance with Medburn to gain entry to a Catholic club. The connections he made there helped him gain position as chaplain to the Protestants in the household of Henry Howard, the future Duke of Norfolk. After being expelled from that post, he converted to Catholicism, hoping, perhaps, that he might find himself better suited to hold down a job in that church. But if that was his goal, he was disappointed because he could never get a job at all among the Catholics. It was in this period that Oates met Israel Tonge, a former clergyman noted for his strongly anti-papist and anti-Jesuit position. Even as Oates took money from Tonge to co-author pamphlets slamming the Catholics, he accepted charity from the Catholic clergy at Somerset House. Oates somehow gained the trust of Father Richard Strange, the foremost Jesuit in England, who arranged for him to go study with the Jesuits in Spain, but he attended for only a short time before being expelled for misbehavior. When Oates returned to England, he claimed to have received a doctorate from the University of Salamanca, a claim that he would continue to make until the end of his life, even though it was patently false. He resumed his dissolute life until Father Strange decided to support him again by sending him to study at St. Omer. I bet you can guess that the results were no different than before, only this time, Oates began to collect information about the Jesuits, information that he would later use to help construct his mendacious narrative. By the time Oates returned to London in July 1678, he was desperate, and when he once again met Tonge, he was more than happy to badmouth the Catholics with whom he had developed a strong acquaintance and to seek a vengeance against them for imagined slights. Tonge encouraged Oates to write everything down, and in short order, the miscreant had produced 43 articles describing a popish plot to murder Charles II and his brother James, the Duke of York. He even named would-be assassins, John Grove and Thomas Pickering, who, according to Oates, were armed with silver bullets and large sums of money. Well, in truth, Oates's accusations came from the same imagination that made him a doctor of Salamanca. Tonge, who was primed to believe in Catholic machinations, took them to heart and was eager to bring evidence of foul play to Charles II. He managed to get word of the plot to the Earl of Danby, who was at that time Charles's first minister, but he effectively dismissed them as false. At that point, Tonge sought another way to get his plot heard by the public, and eventually this new strategy led him to Sir Edmund Godfrey, who met with Oates on September 6th, 1678, to hear his evidence. Although Godfrey took his role as Justice of the Peace seriously enough that he heard Oates' testimony, he was suspicious of the story. He made some kind of report to Edward Coleman, but after that, his actions are obscure. Those who saw him in the last weeks of his life noted that he seemed ill at ease. In the early weeks after his demise, his bad humor was taken as evidence that he was investigating the plot, which ran him afoul of the plotters. But later writers concluded that Godfrey's natural melancholy had worsened. Meanwhile, Oates managed to secure an audience before the King's Privy Council to divulge his information of the popish plot. At that point, his story became even more convoluted, yet several members of the council were convinced of what he said. The thing that seems to have convinced them was that Oates named Edward Coleman, the Duchess of York's private secretary, of handling money for the plot. In making that accusation, he chanced upon one of the men who was already suspected of sympathy towards the papists. If that information was correct, his listeners naturally concluded, perhaps the other things he was telling them were also true. Soon, several Jesuits, a Benedictine lay brother, and several others who were arrested on Oates's word. Then, on Saturday, October 12, 1678, Godfrey disappeared. When his body was found, the local coroner examined it and found marks on the neck to indicate that Godfrey had been strangled before he was impaled by his own sword. He concluded, therefore, that Godfrey had been murdered. News of this mysterious death caused Oates's conspiracy theory to go wild. The word soon spread through London that this good Protestant martyr had been murdered by papists who were trying to keep wraps on the plot that he was about to uncover while investigating Oates's claims. Crowds gathered to see the martyr's body. Catholics were arrested for their presumed role in this imaginary plot. In the end, three Catholic men were convicted and executed for Godfrey's murder. But they would not be the only ones to die. Godfrey's death was taken as proof that Oates was truthful in divulging the popish plot. Oates was invited to appear before the House of Commons to divulge his information. There, he found an audience that had been primed through decades of anti-Catholic propaganda to believe that they were under attack and in imminent danger. Thus, they were willing, at least at first, to believe Oates, who was busy depicting himself as a repentant sinner who had seen the light and was now giving testimony in face of imminent personal danger to save his beloved people. In the end, 35 of the men he named were convicted and executed. The impact of the plot went even farther than these deaths. The Popish plot and the investigations around it led directly to the downfall of Danby when it was discovered that the king's chief minister had written to Louis XIV and asked for money in order to avoid the need to call Parliament. The supposed Catholic plot gave Danby's foremost enemy, Lord Shaftesbury, a rallying point which allowed him, in effect, to forge the Whig Party and to bring together people who agreed with him on his platform of decrying popery, even if they were not necessarily in sync with him on other issues. In the end, this newly forged Whig Party would be instrumental in bringing William of Orange to power in the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Eventually, calmer heads prevailed and the scare subsided. By 1681, the tide had turned against Oates and he found himself accused of libel. In 1682, he lost his pension, which he had been awarded for his role in revealing the plot. And in 1684, he was arrested and tried for perjury. In the end, he was found guilty and sentenced to be imprisoned for life and divested of his role in the church. Before being incarcerated, he was led on a procession from Aldgate to Newgate and whipped the whole way. Thereafter, according to the sentence, Oates was supposed to be moved to various pillories in London 5 times a year to be pelted with rubbish. Oates only served 3 years of his sentence. After his release, he remained a convicted perjurer, but William III secretly paid him a substantial monthly annuity, which he used to move into a house in Westminster, where he continued to write pamphlets about the plot, this time carefully casting both Charles II and James II as papists. When William stopped paying him, Oates married the daughter of a wealthy London draper and collected her inheritance, which he quickly ran through. Oates then tried to support himself by blackmailing his relations and by preaching. This time, however, he lost his position on account of a funeral gone wrong. One of his parishioners, Hester Parker, did not like Oates, and so her executors ensured that he would not be the one to preside over her funeral. In a fury, the ever-vengeful Oates refused to yield the pulpit and preached on a completely unrelated topic at a time that should have been Parker's funeral. In the end, his anger came back to bite him because his congregation ended up expelling him on account of his actions towards Mrs. Parker. We don't know much about what happened to him after that, other than to note that Titus Oates died in July of 1705. Before I wrap things up, I need to ask, who really killed Sir Edmund Godfrey? Sadly, I must tell you that we don't know. It certainly wasn't the Catholics, who had absolutely no reason to kill someone who had always supported them, even if he was looking into a non-existent conspiracy. Some have said that no one killed Godfrey at all, but that he had committed suicide. This theory was particularly favored by Sir Roger L'Estrange, who investigated the matter in the mid-1680s and interviewed some 40 people, all of whom, according to L'Estrange's reports, said that Godfrey had been suffering from melancholy. While suicide is a possibility, I will note that L'Estrange was not above editing the testimony he received, so his reports of depression do need to be taken with a grain of salt. Others have argued that Oates might have dispatched Godfrey himself. He was certainly vengeful enough to do it, though we don't have any other known instances in which he took matters into his own hands. Moreover, while Oates was younger than Godfrey, the older man was noted for his size and his strength, while Oates was more noted for his ruddy complexion and his limp. We also need to consider the possibility that Godfrey's murder had nothing whatsoever to do with Oates. The magistrate had, after all, made numerous enemies over his extended career as a justice of the peace and as a woodmonger. There had been previous attempts on his life, so I will leave his mysterious death a mystery for you to ponder. I hope that you've enjoyed today's episode of Footnoting History, and if you did, you should check out our website, leave us a good review, or even consider supporting our work by becoming a Patreon supporter or by making a one-time donation on Ko-Fi. I hope you'll tune back in for another episode soon. And remember, the best stories are always in the footnotes.